I am Ruth Harbor, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm also a sister, as it's pretty obvious, but I'm primarily an alcoholic. And second, I'm a sister, St. Joseph. Tipton, Indiana is my headquarters. And my sobriety date is August 28th of 1983. And my home group is the Bridge Group, and it's held on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock in Anderson, Indiana. I want to get that out of the way. Yes, I am very nervous about being up here, and I've been nervous for a long time. And first of all, I want to thank the committee for inviting me. When Mark called me about 19 months ago, I figured it out. It was a year ago, February. And I thought, are you sure you want me with that list of speakers that you got? I said, you know, I'm like the little country kid, you know, on the block. And he said, yes, he did. And so I feel very, very honored and privileged. And they've been wonderful. Mark's been great, and so is Cheryl. And I really appreciate being here. It's very hard to be the last speaker because you got all weekend to stew, and then by the time you get done talking, everybody leaves. And it's just very hard. And especially, as Cheryl said, I was very nervous about following Clancy. And I think most of you heard him last night, know why. And I am so glad that he's not here this morning, sitting here in his front seat. I wouldn't want to put him through that torture of listening to a Catholic. Anyway. It's funny, I don't want to extend this any longer because I know we ought to be out here by 12 o'clock. I mean, out of the front door for checking. But, you know, when I pray, and I'll be talking about this later, how I pray today, I never ask God for anything specific anymore. I really don't. I used to ask God, you know, help me drink today and do this, and always telling God what I want and what to do. But today I don't do that, and my prayers are very simple today. I just say, God, whatever your will, you know, I accept that. But you know what? Once in a while, there's a favor that you really want real bad. So I said, God, I talked to God just like this. I said, God, now I don't ask favors, but there's one I'd really appreciate. Maybe Clancy has to catch a plane this morning. And he did. He's going to hear my tape. He already told me he's going to be listening to it on the interstate, and he said he'll probably run into the ditch. Okay, let's get started. First of all, another thing I always do when I give a lead, I talk long, but not only this one, but every time I talk, I always turn it over, ask God, do the talking, and let me just be the mouthpiece. And that's so important, and that's what speakers, I mean, God uses us, speakers, not only speakers, but everybody in the meetings. God, that's the only way God gets the message to us is through others. You know, he's not going to appear to you in a vision. Well, maybe he will, but I kind of question that. But you know, and so I feel like, you know, I've asked God to let me be the mouthpiece and let him do the talking this morning. And I turned this leader over. I couldn't turn it over anymore, and I've turned it over a long, long time ago, and certainly this last couple of weeks and this morning. And because I know for a fact in my own past that I've given leads, and I've heard people come to me later on and say that I had said something that they had heard and that it changed their life and all this, and I don't remember what I said. And you know, it's humbling, it's very awesome too to know that God does that. And as long as I can keep that in mind, that I'm just the mouthpiece up here. And this 24-hour book, I don't know how many of you use it, but I've used it because it was there when I came in this program. And there's a book that the meditations come out of, another book. And I use that this morning. It's called God Calling. If you look in the foreword of the 24-hour book, it tells you that. Those meditations come out of there. And this yesterday morning's meditation was just definitely for me. It says that all we are is a pipe, like a water pipe. All we are is the pipe, and the water passes through us. And my job is that the message passes through me, and that all I do is keep that open and flowing and not to block it. And that's what we are. And all of us are messengers that way. And all we are is here to not to block the message, that God can get the message through. So that's what I'm praying for this morning. I was born and raised out of Fort Wayne. My hometown born and raised in a country south of Fort Wayne. My folks were German, which fits right in around here, and Catholic, of course. It's a very strict religious home. My parents were very staunch Catholics, and I came out of the vintage where God was the punishing God, and he was always up there watching me, And I, everything I did was a sin. I was the oldest of five girls, and I don't have any brothers, so I was the ringleader and always got my sisters in trouble. And I was a tomboy. I just was. But anyway, I had this God. They really put the fear of God into me. At a point that I always knew He was up there watching me, and He was writing down all these things that I was doing, and that the day was going to come when He was going to get me. And that's the way I always had this image of God. Never once did I ever have a God, a loving, caring God. My parents were very strict, and Mom always said, you know, if I did this or that, you know, you're going to get a licking. Well, you know, kids are kids, and our big job was to try to do something, not get caught. And I always got caught, so it was that simple. And it wasn't hardly a day went by that I didn't get a licking of some kind. Another thing that Mom and Dad did was, my mother especially, I mean, and you probably don't get the image of my mother before this very long here. She was the dominant member of our family, and she was the one that called all the shots, and Dad kind of kept quiet, and she always kept telling me how dumb and stupid I was. And she said, you know, you're dumb and you're stupid and you don't have any brain cells in your head. And she really made me feel like I just was nothing. And I shouldn't talk like this, especially a nun, but I got to use the word because my mom told me that all the time, that I'm an asshole. And the reason I have to say that is because even today, after all this time, if I don't keep to work my program and go to meetings and keep current and spiritually fit in this program and do my quiet time every day and get this positive image of God, my mother's tapes start kicking in, even yet today. So that's why I had to mention that, because it's that strongly embedded in me. As far as alcohol, my parents were not alcoholic. However, my mother did come from an alcoholic home. My grandfather died of it, and so did her brother. So she had no use for alcohol. We had it in the house because my dad, you know, he liked beer, and we had it, and especially working out in the fields and stuff, you know, in the hot day, he would get a case of beer, and then he'd give the guys out there in the field some beer. And we'd get a sip of it once in a while in the glass, and that was all, you know, I never had any problem with it when I was little. I went to parochial school and taught by the nuns, of course, and I was always having a hard time in school because I thought I was the ugliest and dumbest and stupidest kid in the class in the school. And so I had my image, as I said, I always never fit in. And this is what everybody, every alcoholic I think I ever heard talk to say that. I always still, I never fit in. I was always the oddball. So I went to finish grade school. I went to first year high in the public school. And then my mother and dad thought I was such a bad kid they were going to send me to a boarding school for girls. So they shipped me to Tipton, Indiana, which is the headquarters of our sisters, our mother house. And I went to the academy there in my sophomore year. I went there, it was the first time I was ever away from home, and I was there 3 weeks when I wanted to be a nun. Well, my mom and dad thought, what on earth did those nuns do to her? Because they thought they really brainwashed me. But the thing was, I was wonderful to get away from home. And number two, I saw these young sisters, these young girls that were learning to be nuns, and they were coming, they're walking around with these little veils on their head, and then I thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice to be a nun? Maybe God had to like me if I was a nun. And that's the only reason I want to be a sister, because I thought God had to like me and also get away from home. Well, you know, actually, that, you know, there's no way that I would have stuck to that and been stayed in the convent. By the way, I am a nun still, and I've been a nun for 56 years. So, it took, you know, more than just that reason. to be a nun. Because I never regretted my decision. So somewhere along the line, God had to actually call me to be a sister. I never regretted my decision. My mom and dad said, okay, if you still want to be a nun after a year, why, we'll let you join. Well, by the way, I was only 15 years old when I made that decision. Now I'm going to tell you how old I am so you aren't sitting here the rest of the morning trying to figure out how old I am. I'm 72. I finished high school in the convent. And I found out the convent life was much like I was at home. Very strict, very regimental. We weren't allowed to touch each other. Mom and dad never touched us at all except to get a licking. We never got any kind of outward expression of love. And it was very, you know, strict that way. And everything was controlled by bells, and we had to, you know, be here a certain place, right, you know, and when this bell rang, not a bell rang, you had to be so and so in places. And I was this good nun, because I'd be sure I followed all those rules, because God was up there watching me. So everything was up here in the head. I had nothing in the heart at all. I was just functioning on the outside as a good nun. And that's how I went through my training. We found out and I had another one. I just want to give an example. We've been in chapel for, you know, we've been for a couple hours, some prayers and things we had to do. The book, we had a prayer book, you know, big book, and to me it was just rallying, let's get these over with for the day, so you know I don't go on. And that's all they were. They was not, had no meaning in anything that I did. And that's the way I functioned. As soon as I finished high school, I went to nurses training, became a registered nurse, and the first thing they did was ship me out to Oregon. We have a hospital out there, and they put me in the operating room, and I loved it. I fell in love with the surgery, and I was going to be the super nurse. And so I just went at it as hard as I could do it. And the doctor started telling me how good I was. I was getting pats on the back. Well, that's the first time ever I ever got any kind of compliment, and I just worked that much harder to be out to be the super nurse. As time went on, we were allowed to go home every 3 years because from the distance coming back and forth from the state across the country. And we weren't drinking in the convent either. We didn't have any alcohol. But my folks, when I would go home, Dad would say, well, maybe you can have some drink when you're home, can't you? You can have some beer. And I said, well, yeah, that didn't count when you're on vacation. So I would have had some beer. But I don't even need to mention that really because all I remember is I felt a taste for it. I got to liking the taste of beer. And even though I didn't get home for 3 years again, I was already looking forward to that time when I could come home for that beer. And as the time went on, my sisters got married. I want to hurry this along. My sisters got married. And in Fort Wayne, and I entered the convent, as I said, when I was just young, and we weren't doing a lot of, I never had a date or anything in those days, back in the early days, and they said, also, the way we dressed got changed. I want to be sure and tell you that. That's so important right now, because when I entered for 20-some years, I dressed, you know, like a full-blown nun, you know, but the habit, as Francie says, that's what we used to call them, the habit. Yeah, it was a habit. And we wore those, and then we went modified dress, something like I'm wearing today, and then when we were out public, we could wear light clothes. So when I would go home on vacation, my sisters would plot ahead of time. They're going to show me how the other half of the world lives, because, you know, I never got a chance to see it. So they would pick places in Fort Wayne that they themselves wouldn't even normally go to because they wanted to shock me. And so I would come home and they would go out to these places. When I'm in Fort Wayne, I name some of these places, and I always get a gasp in the audience, and I think anytime an alcoholic gasps, it has to be bad. But that's true. And so they took me, and I saw it all. The reason I mentioned it is because I got drunk every time. I mean, strip joints, gay bars, I saw the whole bit. I mean, everything. And they would keep my glass filled with beer, and I would gulp it down like water because I didn't know how to drink. And I would get drunk every time. And I'd be in the bathroom half the time ripping my shoestrings, and I'd be so sick. And I thought, and I couldn't only see half the show. That's another bit. And so... I was a normal person. So anyway, that's what happened every time. And then I would go home. I would go to find him. I don't think they ever get out of there and go home. And then I'd go back to my sister's where I had the car because I had my folks' car because I had to stay at my family, my folks. And then I would drive home about 4 o'clock in the morning and tiptoe in the house. Now, this is a nun, tiptoe in the house. I'd get in bed without Mom and Dad hearing me. And I'd just get to bed, and my mom would wake me up at 6 to go to church. She thought nuns should go to church every day. So she'd get me up to go to church. And you can imagine the shape I was in. And she did not know that I'd been up. And so I had to pretend like everything was fine and I'd been in bed. And I remember a couple of times, I remember kneeling there during the Mass, and I fell over the pew. I think I qualify by now. So anyway, she wondered what was wrong with me, and I'd say, well, it's the jet lag. I just flew in from Oregon. And she didn't know what jet lag was, so I used that excuse the whole time I was in Indiana. By the way, I have 2 sisters that qualify for this program, and so I would spend a lot of time in my sister's house, and we'd sit around and drink and talk about Mom. That was our pastime. Because she was on us a lot, and on me a lot, too, and I had a hard time with my mother. Anyway, as time went on, I had a severe head injury where I fell off a bicycle and I fractured my skull. And it was very critical, and the doctors thought I was going to be a vegetable. Here I was running the operating room, and I couldn't function in the surgery anymore. They still kept me in there, and I'd come and leave because I had blackouts. Now, blackouts and a head injury is different than an alcoholic blackout. I would function, and all of a sudden, I mean, I'd be doing something and my mind would go blank, and I mean blank, and I couldn't even finish what I was doing. I mean, even so much as biting right in the middle of a sentence, I couldn't even finish the sentence. Then I had to go leave and lie down and come back the next day and maybe a little, you know, do a little bit better. But that's what happened. What happened was, see, I was, my whole life depended on being a super nurse. And since I couldn't be a super nurse, I was nothing. And so I, my self-image just went downhill real fast. I got a real severe depression, to the point that doctors put me on antidepressants because they were worried. Well, during, by that time, the rule had changed that we could have drink alcohol in the house. And so we had some wine in the convent. And the sisters were saying, come on, why don't you just have a glass of wine? Maybe that might cheer you up a little bit. Because I never got into wine. They didn't know about my beer drinking back in Indiana. So, and so I had some wine. And to this day, I have no idea how much I had. But all I remember is I remember the feeling. It was wonderful. And I thought, why? Wow, this warm glow and everything was wonderful. So I decided, boy, I want some more of this. But I can't take it out of the convent. They see it going down because they had a refrigerator. So I thought, I went out and bought my own bottle of wine. And so I put it in my bedroom closet, and that's when my drinking got started. From that time on, it was very gradual, but it was just one of the things. It was, I was still enjoyed it. I mean, it was not a creating a problem at that time yet, but it's like our disease does, it progresses. And I was getting where I was drinking more and more. I still was, I wasn't into heavy drinking then yet, but one thing that kind of changed the story on me, it was at sometime in there, we were invited to Thanksgiving Day. Every Thanksgiving I get squirrely. I see it's coming up again. So, but what happened was that at Thanksgiving Day, we were invited to some friends' house. There were some nurses there at the hospital. And for Thanksgiving dinner, well, we had about 9 nuns there at the time. Well, guess what? Ruth got drunk in front of all the nuns. They had hard liquor. I mean, I didn't know how to drink. I mean, and so I was gulping down this, you know, whiskey and stuff. And well, I got sick. I never did get to the dinner. I was laying on the couch and I can hear voices over in the distance somewhere and I was passed out. And so they had took me home and they brought me, I woke up the next morning. I slept it off, woke up the next morning and they told me how I acted and I felt so horrible and so ashamed and so embarrassed. I thought, I just can't, they just think I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't even know what the word alcoholic meant at that time, but I just remember they think I'm a drunk. And I felt so horrible. And the sisters let me know they didn't appreciate, you know, that me acting like this. And so anyway, that was Friday. By Saturday morning, I woke up and I said, you know, I can't do this. I can't handle it. I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to commit suicide. Now that's just how fast it went. So I remember that morning as clear as it happened yesterday. I remember getting up that morning and I said, I remember putting on some thicker, I remember exactly what I wore that morning. I put those clothes on. They were the oldest things I had. And I thought, now if I wear this, they can't use these. But all my other clothes, they probably can give them to somebody else. You know, they'll be useful to somebody. So I'll wear something that they don't need, you know. I mean, I was just really down. And I said to myself, if I do this, my folks are going to just, you know, their daughter, a nun, you know. I thought mom and dad could care less, probably anyway. And I didn't even care. And then I said to myself, you know, if I do this, the black market's going to leave on the sisters. And I could just see the headlines of the paper, and the sister commits suicide. Can you imagine that? Or nun commits suicide, no. And I didn't care. I was past that stage. But the point is, what really got me, and I look back today, is that I knew if I did this, I'd go to hell. And you know, I didn't even care. I didn't even care if I'd go to hell. That's just how bad I wanted out. And you know, I look back, and I want to say a little bit about that. And I've been doing this lately, because I mean, I talked to some student nurses here this week. And I was telling them, I said, you know, when I was a surgical nurse, and I worked in the emergency room, too. I mean, I had both departments. And I'd be in the ER, and I had no patience with girls or women, well, not mostly women, that people would come in, OD, overdose. They'd take some pills, and then they'd call somebody. And I could figure, what's the point of calling somebody? I mean, if you're going to do it, do it. I mean, that was terrible. I was not a very sympathetic nurse. But that's just the way I felt. But that's the way I felt about this. I thought, if I do this, I got to be darn good and sure it is 100% perfect. I mean, there's no way that I'm going to come out of this. I could not face anybody if I tried this and didn't succeed. So the only way I knew to do it was jump in the river. I cannot swim. I still can't swim. I took 2 courses in swimming, and I flunked them both. So I just cannot swim. So anyway, I knew, and I had a place where I exactly knew where I could go and jump in, and nobody would find me. Until God knows when, that made no difference. But I mean, darn good and sure it worked. So that is what my plans were. But I wanted to say while I finished talking about the compulsion. when I got to a certain point, when I said I was going to do this regardless, I had a drive inside of myself that made me, just compelled me to do it. There's no way on God's earth I'd be standing here today if somebody hadn't stopped me. I would have had done it. There was a nun came along and wanted to know what I was going to do, and I said, leave me alone, none of your business, and I got kind of nasty with her, but anyway, I was driven to do this. And I just want to say, if you get people that talk about suicide, for heaven's sakes, take them serious. And if they're in shape like I am, there's no talking that's going to do any good. I mean, you can talk, you're blue in the face. But if you take that person physically and get them some help. I just want to say that little bit because it gave me a whole different viewpoint of suicide, and maybe God allowed this to happen. Because I said, there was a drive there that I had to do it. I just had. I mean, I couldn't stop myself. That's why I believe today, I don't even have said this, but I believe any suicides do not go to hell. I don't believe that. They're past it. They're not responsible. I already believe that today. And that's changed my total changing around since this happened to me. Anyway, I went into, I argued with this nun, and of course we were even rattled a little bit, and we nuns don't generally do this. she was convinced, and she didn't know what I was going to do, but something told her to do something, and I say again, it's God. So she got me back in my room and locked the door and called the doctor, and I was in a psychiatric hospital just a couple hours later. I was in there for 6 weeks for possible suicide and acute depression. And not once did anybody ask me if I drank. Who would ask a nun if they had a drinking problem? Maybe today, but not back then in 83, or no, 73. So anyway, I after that, the next 3 years, I was in and out of psychiatric hospital repeatedly. I can't even begin to tell you how many times I was in and out. It's just all a bad dream. And finally, I thought, I was drinking all this time. And my drinking was starting to increase, and I was getting more and more and more. And finally, I decided I got to get out of this place because my personality was changing, like this disease does to us. And I was getting fussy with the doctors, and didn't like the nurses, and I didn't like the nuns, and I didn't like anybody and the way things were going. So I ended up, I said I had to get transferred, and I asked for a transfer, and they sent me to Fort Wayne. And I came back there, and I lived in a student nurse's home, worked at St. Joseph's Hospital there in Fort Wayne as an operating room nurse. And I loved it there because a lot of the young girls, ran around with the young girls there, and I found a lot of the girls liked to party. And so we did a lot of partying at night. We'd go out at night in different places, and I was a real popular nun in those days. They weren't used to nuns being like that, but I loved it. But by that time I got into wine totally. The reason I stuck to wine is because we're on a budget. We don't have a lot of money. And so the whiskey and stuff is too expensive. And beer, I thought I was too fattening. I was going through that phase, and besides, it was more expensive. And so wine was the best thing. And what I did, I would get the cheapest, crummiest wine they got on the shelf, and I would go down the aisle and I look at the price tag, and that's all I did. And whatever was cheapest, that's what I bought. I didn't care what it tasted like. All I cared about was what it did to me, and that's what I did. And then I got in my, and then I got to thinking. I heard about crossing the line. If you ever get to a point where you might, you can't stop. And I thought, well, before I do that, I better quit. So then I would try to quit. Well, that's a joke too. And I would get a bottle of wine, and I would get a couple drinks, and then I just no more had that couple drinks, and I look at that bottle and I say, I just can't do this. I just can't. I gotta quit. I just gotta quit before I get where I can't quit. And I would throw the rest down the drain. And then I find out that I no more had that bottle down the drain, or certainly by the night, that same night, or not the next day, and I go back out and buy another bottle. And when I found that I could not quit, I was absolutely petrified. I thought, now what do I do? What am I going to do? I'm the only nun in the whole world that's got this problem. Who could I talk to? Nobody knows. I mean, what can I? I didn't know what to do. I panicked. But in the meantime, in my drinking, now I'm starting to have blackouts. And here I worked in the operating room, and I would be in there several times when I got up and got in the case and didn't even know I'd been up. I didn't even know I'd been in the operating room until I heard about it the next day, or somebody would ask me about it. And then you try to find out without them knowing you don't know, And that's what I would try to do. And it was just terrible. And I got so scared. And my drinking is starting to increase and increase. And then I went to DT two different times while I was in Fort Wayne because how I drank. I couldn't predict, I was going to have what was going to happen. And I remember two different times. I remember laying there on the bed in my room, and I would see these gremlins like you have on Halloween, all crawling around my window and the drapes and my bed and my dresser. And I'd lay there and I'd just freeze and I'd close my eyes and I'd pray they'd be gone in the morning. And at least two different times I went through that. So there I was. I didn't know, what to do. I couldn't understand why I couldn't quit, because, you know, I want to say this, you know, priests and nuns, I mean, we're trained for discipline and, I mean, in our lifestyle, discipline and willpower and penance and mortification, you know, that's the kind of stuff, you know, I was raised with that in the convent. And I used to give up the hardest things for Lent, you know, I thought the more it was, the harder it was to do, either to give up or to do, whichever way it went, that, you know, God had to like me better, you know, it's always that. And I would give up the hardest things I could think of, and I could do it. I developed a strong willpower that I could really give this up, or I could really do something I didn't want to do. Because I thought, as I said, the more merit I would gain from that. But when it came to alcohol, I tried to give up wine, and I couldn't get through, I mean, like on Lent, you know, I tried to give it up for Lent, I couldn't get through Ash Wednesday. And I thought, what's wrong with me? I couldn't understand it. I just tried. I mean, I had no idea that this disease, you know, we had no willpower in alcoholism. And I was so relieved when I went in treatment and they told me that, because I couldn't understand why I could not stop. Well, it got so bad that I decided I want to get out of here before I get caught. See, I was still scared to death I was going to get caught. I knew I was going to, I mean, the nurses all knew it. I mean, it wasn't that. But I mean, something would happen in surgery. That's what worried me. An emergency or something that I couldn't function, and that would be real big trouble. So I asked for a transfer back out to Oregon again. And I went back out to Oregon. By that time, we only had two nuns left out there. And I went, took me back in the operating room. I wasn't a supervisor this time. But those doctors out there were top-notch board-certified men. And I thought, and I was so scared. I was only in there a short time when I decided, I'm going to slip up somewhere sometime, and one of these doctors going to find out. So rather than get caught, I gave up the operating room. Rather than get caught, I gave up surgery. And I miss it to this day, because I always loved surgery. It was my first love in nursing. They put me in pastoral care as a sister visitor. And that was a great job for me, because I had no boss, and I could be my own boss. And I could come and go, and I could make rounds, and often wonder, as always, and see, I had to keep drinking. I had to be a maintenance drinker, because if I didn't drink, I would go into DTs. So I was just locked in this prison, as I call it. And so I was scared to death what was going to happen. And so I left the operating room. I went around visiting the patients, and I often wonder what kind of visits I made in those days, because I was always under the influence. So as the time went on, I remember just, as I said, the walls were starting to close in on me. My alcoholism was progressing, and I was getting where I couldn't, I was angry all the time. I had all the isms that, you know, was coming out in full bloom. But I didn't understand any of this. I got where I was totally, totally obsessed with alcohol. All I could think about was getting my bottle in, getting my supply, my empties. I never kept an empty around the place, by the way. I never, because I thought they found an empty, they know I drank it. So I made sure I always took my empties to the store, and I had to drive to the store, because we had a brand new hospital way out in the country. We had to drive about 2 miles in town. And I wait till sister went to work, and then I would get my empties and send them in the car, and I'd go over to the store, and then I would dump them in the dumpster behind the building. You know, I wouldn't even get out of the car. I'd just pitch them in the bins. And then I would go in, and then I would get my supply out and get it back home. And I had as many as 4 and 5 gallons of wine hidden around the house at one time. Now, this is ridiculous. I mean, I had them behind the wood pile, in the wood locker, the clothes hamper, any place I could hide a jug of wine. But the thing was, and then the first snowflake would fall, and I'd panic. I couldn't get my supply. Well, you people know what it's all like. But it was awful. And I got so scared. But the biggest thing that scared me was I was going to get caught. And I had drank just enough to get by, because I wouldn't slur my speech, or I wouldn't stumble when I went to work. And I could get to the day, but I had it as a maintenance drinker. As soon as I hit the house, I'd get a drink, and then I'd wait till supper was over, and then sisters both went to bed early, and I was so glad of that. So after they went to bed, then I could drink till I passed out. Get up 2 o'clock and wake up and drink some more till I passed out. And this is where I was, and this is when the walls, as I were closing, it was like being locked in prison, bound in chains. I can't, in any way I would better describe it. It was like I was totally, it was a fear, it was beyond anything you can imagine. I was totally fear. The suicide looked better all the time. So this time I thought, my darn, I'm going to do it this time, and there's nobody going to stop me. Well, I hadn't really got into the details. We moved out to the, see, we're not in the same place now. So I hadn't worked out the details of how I was going to do it. Well, I know it's going to be the river, but I hadn't got into all the plans of it yet, like I did the first time. That same nun was there. And she got suspicious that I was starting the way I was acting and the way I was talking. So instead of even confronting me, she just wrote in, she wrote to Indiana to our mother superior, and she said, Ruth needs help, and she needs it fast, and I'm not going to be responsible for anything happens to her out here. And so naturally, as soon as that letter hit Indiana, I got a phone call, and they said, you know, you've been dealing with depression all this time. See, it's always been depression. Of course, the alcohol just fed right into that, you know, but I was a negative person from the day I was born. I mean, that's just the way I've always been that way. And I have to fight it even to this day. So I went anyway. She said, we're going to get help for you. I don't care where it is or how much it costs or what. We're going to get help for you once and for all. We've been dealing with this for years. They sent me to a place out of San Francisco. It's a place for priests and nuns, but it was not an alcohol center. Of course, they didn't know about the alcohol. And they sent me there for evaluation. And I went there, and when they got through testing me, they said that I might have another problem besides depression. And so they said that, and they said they might have a suicide on their hands. And I was 2 blocks from the Pacific Ocean. Somebody, was it Calancy that couldn't find the ocean? I was 2 blocks from the ocean. And I knew, I could see it from my bedroom window. And I looked at that water and I thought, boy, that's enough water to do it, you know. but anyway, the only thing that made me not do it is that my mother superior made me promise that I would call her the minute I got my evaluation back. So when I got the evaluation, I told her what they had told me, that they couldn't take me, that they thought I had another problem, and I didn't know what it was, and I told her, and she didn't act shocked, or I didn't hear anybody faint on the other end or anything. And I said they recommended a place on the East Coast that they wanted for me to go, and it was for priests and nuns. That's all they take there. And she said that's the place they get a real good success rate there. And she says, well, why don't you go ahead and go? And I waited for her to say one negative thing so I could jump in there, walk in the ocean. But anyway, she says, why don't you go ahead and go? And she said, take the evaluation test. And she said, if you know, and you don't have to say, maybe you might find out something. And then she said, besides, she says, whatever you do, you know, whatever, we're 100% behind you, and you're worth every penny. So what could I do but at least go through the testing? So 10 days later, I flew out back to Indiana. I clear over to Indiana. I went to Maryland. That's where I ended up, in Maryland. To Suitland, Maryland, is the Praise St. Luke Institute, and that's where I ended up. Well, when I got through the testing there, they told me that I had, number one, alcohol. I was an alcoholic. Well, that's a horrible word. I heard it. Number two, I had acute depression. Number three, I had brain damage. That was my diagnosis. Well, when I heard that word alcoholic, I said, okay, God, you did it. I was always waiting the day he's going to get me, and he made me an alcoholic nun. I couldn't think of anything worse. Anything worse than that. I mean, I thought I was a curse of the gods now, for sure. Oh, I never forget. This program, and see, but God, I'm the wisdom, and looking back, the more I think of this, the more I wisdom of this. This program is 4 months long. And this is back in 83. And 4 months long. And I was there for 6.5 months. I mean, 4 months is minimum. So I was there, but I'm so glad that I had that program, because it took that long for me to get to what I needed to get, and to get this through my head, you know, that I bought this disease. I could never made it today in these kind of programs. I just couldn't have made it in a short, like, you know, 28. Well, now it's only 2 or 3 day detox, and then you're out on outpatient. And I wouldn't have done it. See, you know, priests and nuns, you know, we get a lot of workshops and retreats, and you know, and all kinds of things like that. And I know me, I was one of those people that I would come home, I would go to some kind of workshop or retreat, and I'd come home all fired up, and I want everybody to, oh, he's wonderful, you got to do this. And then by maybe a couple weeks later, I'd all die out. And that's just the way I would have done with one of these programs. I'd come home and I wanted you all to join AA, you know, it's just wonderful. And then I'd probably get back around, I'd relapse. I just would. That was my pattern. But in there, see, after being there all this 6.5 months, over a year, I got a chance to work the program. But the thing was, the very first night I was there, I went to an AA meeting. They had 2 van loads of priests and nuns that went around the places in Washington, D.C. is where we went to meetings, because we were running all Washington, D.C. I always think, can you imagine a whole 2 van loads of priests and nuns coming into one of your meetings? But they did that there, and they were used to it. I mean, yes. We were right out of Washington, D.C., and I remember hiding behind these pillars. Most of them are in church basements, you know, I could not get the word out that I was an alcoholic. I couldn't even say it. I was so ashamed and so embarrassed. I just thought I was a curse. I was doomed for life. I just bawled and bawled. The whole first month I did nothing but bawl. I cried. I never could stop crying. Because I was always just thought this was the worst thing that ever happened. You know, but I wanted to say and I had a hard time with the steps when the first started out. The first, I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. I had no question about that. I knew I was powerless. I had no control, whatever. Number two is that there was a higher power that couldn't restore me to sanity. And I knew God could do it, but why would he want to do it to me? You know, and that was just kind of what my attitude was. My third one, I want to go into that later again, but third step is I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Why would I want to turn my will and my life over to the care of God? I was just like saying, okay, God, you can zap me now. I've been waiting for this. I mean, that was my surrender. I mean, that's the way I looked at that. And but what happened was one of the meetings we had to go to was the downtown ghetto, Washington, D.C. And we had a priest director, a psychiatrist and also a priest, and he was excellent for us. And he wanted to give us a flavor of all the different types of AA meetings. And the one we had to go to, one of them, was on Friday night, downtown ghetto. And this was through the winter. And we had to get out. The meeting was up over a liquor store, which is interesting. And they pull us up in front of this liquor store, and there'd be right beside the path that walked to go up. It was their winos out there warming themselves. They had these barrels and, you know, and the typical overcoat and the whole bit, paper bags, and they'd be standing out there. We'd have to go right past them. I couldn't see them yet. And we get up that top of that stairs, and there's a great big bouncer standing up there, and he's watching that stairway. And if one of those winos would wander up there during the meeting, he would throw them out. And I know that meeting ended up being my favorite meeting. The reason it was because these men, most everybody in that room were people that are off the street. These were street people. And let me tell you, when I heard, and these men were talking about that 1 hour of the week to them was their lifeline. And they said nothing's going to stop them from getting everything they can out of that 1 hour. And I heard stories there that I make your hair curl. I have never heard other places. I'll never forget that. It was my favorite meeting. And I never heard such sincerity and honesty and humility as they had in those rooms, and the love and the caring for each other. But what got me was that once in a while, a wino would wander up there that acted like he wanted. He did. One guy would stand up there. He'd say, "Now, if you want help, I think we can help you. But we want you to sit back in the back of the room here and keep quiet now until the meeting's over, and then we'll talk to you afterwards." And he'd go get him a half a cup of coffee because he was shaking. He couldn't even hold a cup in his hand. And then after the meeting, a bunch of those guys, I never get through this. One of those guys would a bunch of them would circle this man, put their arm around him. You can imagine, you could smell him all over the room, you know, how filth and stuff and smell, how they smelled. And that didn't make any difference. And they started talking to him. And I watched that, and I thought, this isn't God in action. I've never seen it. And sometime during that time, God changed for me. And he changed from being the ornery, mean, punishing God to a loving, caring God. And that's when I realized, you know, that's why this program means so much to me. Because you guys gave me back my God. You gave me back your God. I found God in these rooms. I didn't find God in the convent. I didn't find him in my home. I didn't find him in the church. I found him right here around these rooms and these tables. That's why this Alcoholics Anonymous means so much to me. I owe my life to you people. And from that time on, everything changed. So when I was working in treatment, I started working on those steps again. I turned my will and my life over to care of God. Today I say, I surrender my will. I say my will and my life, which is your words. The will is your words, and my life is my actions. Over to your care, and I always put direction, because Bill W., when he wrote the steps, the first time he put care and direction of God. And I'd like to say something about care of God. You know, I heard just recently, a man explained about the care of God. God, you know, it's not, we don't turn our life itself over to God. God doesn't want our life. He wants us to live our own life. He wants us to live our life. He doesn't want it right now. And he says, but we put it in the care. And he says, it's like having an automobile. I can have an automobile, and it's my automobile. I bought it. It belongs to me. But let's say something went wrong with it. I take it over and give it to a mechanic. I put my car in the care of a mechanic, but I don't give him my car. I mean, I just give it to him in a care. And that's what we do with God. We just put our life in God's care, that he takes care of us. And to me, it was just another way of looking at that. And I like that example. So I just wanted to share that with you. Anyway, I finished, I had a hard time getting through the steps, as I said. And, I'm not going to go through all the steps, you know, because we don't have that time this morning. But I had a hard time with the fourth step because I had some closet skeletons in the closet. I certainly didn't want to tell anybody, but I knew for a fact I had to do it. And I knew I wanted, I had to stay sober. I knew for a fact I had to make this program. Because if I, is that, even back in those early days, suicide was still lurching in the rafters for me. I knew if I didn't make this, I couldn't go back and face everybody. And so, I had to work this program. So I worked very hard with it. And I knew that I couldn't leave any skeletons in the closet. I had to get it all out, and I did. And what a relief it is for the first time to be able to free of things I don't have. That's why it's so important to do a good fourth step. Because if you don't, it'll always come back to the surface again, it'll always come back to the surface again, and one of these things, one of these weak moments, you will go back out. I know I would have. I'm going to jump down to the 11th step because that's one of my favorite steps. So it's all through prayer and meditation to increase our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, I always say, ask God to show me what His will is for me today. And I do that with everything I do. I mean, every morning, I ask God, show me. First thing I do, I never attempt to face the day without asking God to show me what His will is for me today. And give me the power and the willingness. I always put willingness in there because sometimes I just don't feel like doing it. You know, there are days when you're just not in a good mood, you know, just lazy and tired, and I don't want to do it. So I ask God to give me the power and the willingness as well to do it, to carry out His will. And then the prayer and meditation, I want to mention that. It talks about prayer and meditation. That's two different things. Prayer is talking, meditating is a listening. And you know how many times we talk but we don't listen. And I know I did. I used to rattle off all these prayers. I never listened to anything. And today it's really important that I do. After I do my prayer time, I'm asking God, there's certain people, specific people I ask. I pray for my girls that I sponsor. And for certain people that I know that are out that are having a rough time and I know personally and all that. But the thing is, I said again, I never pray for specifics. I never ask them to bring them back. See, my two sisters, I used to pray for them that they'd get sober. And I said, pray, please let them get what I have. But I don't pray for that anymore. I don't know if God wants them to get sober or not. And so every day today, I always say, God, I put them in your hands and you give them what's best for them. And if you want them to get sober, it's okay. And if you don't, it's okay too. And that's the way I pray today. You know, it takes all that struggle of begging and pleading out of my prayers. You know, this way, I mean, maybe it's a lazy way, but it works for me. And I do. And I found out that I've gotten a lot more prayers answered since I prayed like this than I did when I asked for specifics. Except for Clancy. I got one that would work. But anyway, that's true. I do. That's the way I pray today. I got just show much your will is to me and give him the power and the willingness. And you take care of him. And you give him what's best for him. And I pray that with everybody. That's the way it just makes it much simpler. Then meditation, what I do, I sit there and I just listen. And I don't talk at all. And that's real hard, especially when we got motor running up here going as fast as it could go. You know, it takes a lot, and I know a lot of people that I've been working with in the program have a hard time getting, you know, calmed down, you know. Well, I don't want to get into some heavy stuff here, but, you know, I always tell people, if you go in just for 2 minutes, just concentrate on your breathing. Just all of a sudden, just imagine that focus. At least get something definite to focus on in your breathing. You know, and I've heard it said, you know, that one way of looking at breathing God in, breathing the dark, all our negative character defects out. But to me, I find it simpler just to breathe God in and out, get in and out. And I just imagine, you know, I just feel just God's presence. I mean, I'm just aware that He's right there. And God is there right there. I mean, I'm not, this is not a makeup job. This really is true. God really is here. He's present everywhere. And I usually use, sometimes I tell Him to use the light, like light, you know, just breathing in, and I just, all of a sudden I feel myself coming fluorescent, you know, just that white light coming in, just God's grace. And I allow that to have, just, and you won't believe the difference it makes for the day. After I've done that for the day, I can go out and face the world, and I carry that awareness through the day. It's just amazing. And sometimes, sometimes I feel like cold as a dead fish. I feel like God went off and left me, you know. I mean, we're not going to feel warm and gushy all the time. I know there are a lot of days I just feel real dry. But that doesn't make any difference. I've had that date with God that morning, and that was important. And so, but what happens is that during the day sometime, maybe somebody will say something, and, oh, just hit me right here. Or, I mean, I'll see something, or I'll read something. I've read it before, and all of a sudden it bounces off the page at me. And I'm a nature lover. I always love nature. We have a lake right there in Anderson, and I walk around that lake every morning. And every chance I can, and I look around that lake and I think, God put all this here for me to, not just for me, for us to enjoy.
And you know, and I think, how many times did I go through life, when I, especially when I was out there drinking, I saw nothing. You know, I just, and I said, we got birds and squirrels and geese and swans and ducks and, you know, and I look at those, and we got blue heron out there. Once in a while I get a chance to see one of them, and when I do, I just stop and I say, God, thank you. Because right there at that moment, I had, that bird had to be right there at that moment, and I was right here. You know, I could have gone right by and never seen any of that. And it just puts me on a high. It just does. I think about my sunrises. You know, now we have beautiful sunrises. My window faces east. And you know, my mother used to get me up at 6 o'clock in the morning. That was the last thing I wanted to see was a sunrise. And you know, but today, you know, I'm grateful for that. And but I want to say one other little thing that I just came across here in some readings here just recently, that about God being present. How, one other way of helping us be aware of God's presence. It's just like a God is everywhere. He's in the air we breathe. He's ever in my, if he stops not being here, my heart will stop beating because he's keeping me alive. It's like a fish in the water. You know, just a fish in the water. God, that's what we are. We're like, God is just like the ocean is the water. I mean, and that's the way we are here. God's everywhere. He's right here in this room. I prayed real hard for this weekend. And I know God gave us this program. I am so convinced that God gave us this 12-step program. And I think one of the other speakers touched on that. You know, I feel like when God looked down on this earth, and back in the early, all the years since creation, up until 1935, he looked down on this earth and alcoholics were going down the tube. I mean, we had there was nothing, no recovery for us. There was no cure for us. We're all dying. We're considered hopeless and the outcast. And God looked at all of us down here and he said, I'm going to give them some help. So he got two drunks together and he says, I'm going to give them a program that works. And so he did. He put Bill and Bob together. And he gave us this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Another thing is he did that in Akron, Ohio. And that's another thing. When I talk in Ohio, I always tell this. I said, it's very special to talk in. I say when I cross that line, when I go from the Indiana line over to the Ohio line, I feel like I'm on precious ground, because I just feel that wonderful about the state of Ohio. Look at this. Think about this. You know, since the beginning of the world, there was no solution for alcohol. God looked down on this earth and he thought, where am I going to have this happen? And he picked 1935 and he picked the state of Ohio and the city of Akron. I think he could have picked Australia or India or South America and maybe back 100 years ago or maybe not even till after next down the years or, you know, coming down the pike, but he gave it to us in 1935. And how blessed that we are right here in this area. We're all neighboring states of Ohio, right close to the very heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's such a privilege. If you ever get a chance to go to Akron, please do so. There's nothing like it to go to Dr. Bob's house and stand right there on the very spot where this program got started. I've had the great privilege of being there several times, and I sat there at that kitchen table this September, I believe it was. We were there for the Archives Convention. I sat at the kitchen table and drank a cup of coffee on Dr. Bob's kitchen, and that was just really something special. You can just feel their spirit there. Anyway, I kind of got off the track on that, but anyway, I want to talk. I just want to say too about this is, you know, everybody talks about this being a religious. This is not a religious program, and newcomers kind of get scared off when they hear about this. This is not a religious program. This is a spiritual program, and all that means is a way of living. But we work the 12 steps. This is a way of life for us. It's nothing to do with going to a church. It's I say anybody that it's a supplement. I mean, churches can be a supplement, but not a substitute. You know, if anybody should have found God in church, I certainly should have found Him in church, and yet I found Him right here in these rooms. I think God was there. My image was warped with God. That was the only problem. But you know, we say religion is man-made, and God and spirituality is God-given. And all spirituality is living the 12 steps. You know, like being loving and caring and forgiving and honest and trusting. You know, and just work and just treat people like you want to be treated. People that have trouble with the word God, I always tell them, add another O, make the word good, and live a good life. That's all spirituality is. It doesn't do with any going to any church. I know a lot of people that they start going to the program and get in the program a while, they might eventually want to go to a church, and they do, you know, or go to the one that they once when Tom was a member, or join a church, and that's fine. I want to show God gratitude for what He's given me. And it is a form of worship. But it's not a requirement. It's not a requirement. And I know a number of people that when they started got into AA, they got all in a pink cloud, they got all wound up, you know, and then my eyes, wonderful, I've got to go to church now, you know, and then they come and they go to church in the same fire, and they're all born again Christians, you know, this time, and I'm not knocking into this, but I'm just saying what's happened, I've seen a number of times it's happened. And they say, well, you know, I don't need to go to AA anymore, you know, I got nine, I'm going to church now instead. And this about every single person that I have known that done that has gone back out. I mean, and that's just, that's, you know, I think, you know, we got to get this. You know, I live my life better today as a nun by working these 12 steps than I ever did before. I mean, just by working the 12 steps. This 12 steps is so powerful, so wholesome. That's why so many other groups have adopted this. It's a basic way of living for anybody. You don't have to be an alcoholic to live this. This is a good way of life for anyone. And the wisdom, the more I'm in this program, the more I marvel at the wisdom of this program with Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a total miracle to me. I always tell it, well, before I get too far, but everybody's starting to leave here. By the time I get done, everybody's probably hall will be empty. But this is something I've been using here. Somebody gave me this. This is Ruth. That's the way I was when I was drinking it. We had to find a name for her, and I've had her all over. And in Canada, they decided we call her. We ended up calling her Ruthless Ruth. So. That's what she is. But, you know, another thing about priests and nuns. You know, I feel like I had such a hard time with this program because I felt like that the guilt and shame. I think we carry much more guilt and shame than the average alcoholic does. And well, that's pretty bad because we all carry a lot of shame. But I think priests and nuns do more than the average, because see, we're kind of looked up. You know, people look up to us. We're supposed to be people, you know, of God, and we're supposed to show others how to live. You know, we're kind of a role model. And you know, and then to think that here I am an alcoholic, I couldn't think of anything worse than that. And my guilt and shame was just, almost unbearable. I'll never forget that. That was one of the main reasons why I wanted to commit suicide, because I just thought it was just so terrible. The one thing we call, this program's been called, and I like to use this, is the precious diamond. There's a friend of mine over in Cleveland that calls it a diamond, and he calls me every once in a while, and he wants to know, he says, are you keeping your diamond polished? It's a precious jewel. And it's my job, and he says, my job is to keep it polished, and that's what we're supposed to do. And God gave us this diamond, this jewel, and it's our job to keep it polished. And if we don't, He'll give it to somebody who will. I mean, that's what we do. That's what we're doing here today. By coming here this weekend, we're polishing our diamond. I'm doing it up here, giving the lead by doing service work, by making coffee, anything, sponsoring people. That's all polishing our diamond, because that's all we have, is a precious jewel. And think of the thousands of people that are out there on the streets, you know, today that are dying from the disease. Not only alcohol, but drugs. And why are we so blessed and so privileged? And when you think of the percentage of alcoholics and drug addicts in recovery, it's the minimum compared to what the prevalence of it is it out there in the streets. And I think how we're so blessed. I know for me, I have another thing I got to be grateful for. I always got to be grateful. And every time, the more I can be grateful, the more quality of sobriety I have. My greatest quality is to keep my will turned over to God. The more I can surrender my will to God every day, and total surrender, the more quality sobriety I have. That's what it's all about, is that total surrender. And that's such a hard word. You know, surrender is a hard word for alcoholics, because that's the last thing we want to do. You know, our disease brings out, you know, we got all the isms. We got to be in control. You know, I got to be in charge, and my self-centeredness and my ego. And that's one of our main character defects, is being in control. And I guess why it's so hard so many people don't make it, because they cannot give up the surrender. They cannot give up the surrender. It's so hard. Turn it over. We plant a seed. Every time we go to a meeting, I think we plant a seed, for a newcomer, for anybody who comes into these rooms. And our job is to, all we do is to plant the seed. We don't have to know what the results of it are. And I heard this compared like an apple seed. We have, you know, we can pick up an apple and we can count the seeds in an apple. But we have no idea how many apples are in a seed. We have no idea. And I know for me, you know, I found that out a number of times, that I've planted a seed and didn't even know till later that people had come back. I know for a fact there's at least two people for certain that are alive today because they heard my lead. And, you know, that is pretty, I mean, that's scary. One man, back in Akron again, I'm going to use this example today. In Akron, last year at Founders Day, I was walking across the yard to go to breakfast, and this man was standing there in the driveway, a pathway, and he saw my name. We had big name tags, and he yelled my name, Sister Ruth, and, you know, just yelled it out, and I didn't know who he was, and he says, I know you don't know this, but he said, 4 years ago, you kept me from jumping off the bridge. And I didn't know what he's talking about. And he said he had heard my tape. He hadn't even met me. And he says that he was going to commit suicide. And he said, whatever I said in that lead, in that tape, what he heard, he said, and that was 4 years, and he's still alive. In fact, I spoke for him in Dayton here a few weeks ago. And so, you know, it just shows. And then I have another man that was going to commit suicide the night he was in the meeting when I gave the lead. And he said the only reason he was there that night because his wife told him, he thought if he went, his wife was trying to talk him into going to an AA meeting. Because he's been having a lot of problems. And he says, I thought, well, if I go to a meeting, she can say at least that he tried. He was at an AA meeting that night. And that was the only reason he was there. And that was 3 years ago, and he's alive today. So, you know, it just shows. I mean, I never know. Maybe somebody has a message. God has a message for somebody in this room today. You know, we don't know that. Hopefully, if that's true, that they hear it and that I didn't get in the way of that. I want to say one thing about my mother. I can't leave you thinking that my mother and I are at odds today. My mother passed away while I was in treatment, very unexpectedly, and she did not know I was in treatment. I told her I was going away to school, and she didn't know the difference. And my sisters knew it, but she didn't. I never told my mother and my father. And the last time I talked to her was an argument on the phone, and so when my sister told me that my mother passed away in the emergency room at the hospital in Fort Wayne, they let me go home, but I had a real hard time with that. And I was so grateful that I was in treatment at the time that they could work with me on it. What they did, they had me write a letter to my mother to tell her everything that I wanted to tell her when she was alive, and I could never do that. And so I did, and I still had that letter today. And then to go out to the cemetery and talk to her. And you know, the longer I'm sober and the more I look back at my mother and my father, you know, my mother and father, you know, they, for 16 years, you know, my parents, they fed me, you know, and they clothed me. And they housed me, and they doctored me, and they took care of me. And, you know, they were hardworking farmers. And, you know, they didn't have a way of expressing their love. That was their way to express their love, you know. But, you know, we as kids didn't see that, you know. And besides, you know, the question is not what kind of a parent I had, but think what kind of daughter I must have been. So I was always testing the waters, you know. I was always testing to see if I get by without getting caught. You know, I always got caught, see. So I wasn't an ideal daughter either. And I look back at my parents, you know, we didn't have the outward expression of love, but we had it all with the way we were always fed and took care of, and they were hard workers, and never once, we had no sexual abuse or anything like that in my family. And the more I've been around here and have seen the people in the world and stories I've been hearing, my mom and dad look better all the time. They really do. And then my father died a month after I got out of treatment. I was just home 1 month when my father passed away. And he did not know I was in program either. And I think God blessed, I mean, the way I'm relieved that God blessed them and that, they didn't have to know. So that's just something I needed to say. I'm going to close because it's getting time. One important thing I wanted to say too is that I've changed, if anybody's heard my stories years ago, I used to say that I think we're chosen. I know we are chosen. We are chosen, but not the way I thought before. I think we are, but the thing we are chosen is that God, I think God offers to get the sobriety to everybody. I think God, you know, God is a loving, open, I mean, free God. Why would God say, well, okay, you're going to get drunk, and you're going to get in recovery, I mean, and you're going to get locked up, and you're going to die. Does that sound like God? I mean, I don't think he does that. He offers to get the sobriety to everybody. He says, here it is. Do you want it or don't you? I mean, you've got the gift. Here it is. Do you want it? And how many times have you heard leads? And almost every time I hear a story, that somewhere in their life, they'll finally say, God help me. It always comes to that when they hit the bottom. And that's the time when then God takes over. But he's not going to force it on us. God will not force it on us. And I really believe that today. Now that's just my own opinion. I mean, you don't have to believe that. I'm just saying. But I know for me, it just fits better than saying that, okay, God just chooses certain ones to get sober and other ones you don't. Well, God never takes our free will away from us. He never takes the free will, ever. That's, you know, we have the choice. We have the choice. So I want to say, I'm going to close with this one little simple prayer. But first of all, I got one little thing, how I had the surrender thing that I always use. I can't even find it now. Well, I guess I won't. Yes, I do. This is talking, I like to look at this every so often and realize, you know, and in this example, I mean, I do this every day. There isn't a day goes in that I don't take something back, you know, and then I give it back again and I take it back, and I think that's just life. And I think, you know, God understands that. As long as we keep taking, as long as we let go of it again. As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because He was my friend. But then instead of leaving Him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last I snatched him back and cried, "How can you be so slow?" "My child," he says, "what could I do? You never did let go." And I thought, that's, you know, that's the way it is sometimes. And the one story I almost forgot to do, and I would be the first. I've given over several hundred leads, and only one other time I forgot this. I can't say today, I don't want to forget it. There's a story that I was told while I was in treatment, and I never want to forget it because it, to me, it's a very precious story, and I use it all the time. And this is actually true. One of our therapists at that treatment, when I was in treatment, was a priest from another order, and he had missionary priests over in Europe. So they came back with this story, because it's a true story. It's nothing that's made up. But they do. They have a lot of grazing country over there, and they have a shepherd. And they would often have a lamb that wanders from the flock all the time, and he would always keep trying to get in trouble and trying to go through the fence and go over the crevice. And I was, boy, that was Ruth if I ever saw it. And, you know, and is always getting in trouble. And what he would do, he would watch that lamb for a while, and then after a while, he would finally pick that lamb up, and he'd break his two front paws. And he'll put the lamb around his neck, however long it takes for those bones to heal. And you'll see pictures of the shepherd with the lamb around his neck. And he just leaves it up there. And he goes about his work every day, you know, and it doesn't bother him. And then after, when those bones are healed, he'll put that lamb back down in the fold. And what happens is that lamb's in so close to the shepherd all that time that he knows every command the shepherd gives. And he knows every rule, and he's the first one to obey. And he often ends up being the leader. And he told us that every one of us in this room, now this is a treatment center, but it's just for us two, every one of us in this room came in here broken. There isn't a single one of us that ever came in here saying, "Well, I don't have anything else to do today. I think I'll join AA." You know, we had to break us to get our attention. But the thing is, you know, we're in the process of being healed. We're in the process of being recovered. That's how we're learning this program, and that's what we're doing now. We're in the process of being healed. But the thing is, we have the responsibility of going out and helping others. We got to go out and help another alcoholic. You know, this program is built in that way. That, you know, we got to go out and help another person. That's the only way to say we want to keep it, by giving it away, and that's what we mean. We've got to help another alcoholic. And that's why I feel so privileged today. You know, I feel like that we're the broken lambs that God has carried and got us in here. And so, but I feel too, I am, the more I'm in this program, the more I'm convinced that we are responsible. God's given us this gift, so what are you going to do with it now? What are you going to do with it? And my job is, you know, I feel like I'm just now doing God's work. I was actually about 60 years old. I was 57 years old when I got in here. I never did tell you that. 57 years old when I got in here. But I was about 60 when it finally hit me. I just now feel like I'm doing God's work, and that is to pass the message. I think all along, if you could keep me alive long enough, that if you'd get me in this program to do this, that I feel my nursing was all fine. But today I feel like I'm here to pass the message on. And I feel like, because definitely God is using me. And I think, and as long as I just feel so privileged and so honored. And I feel, not only that, but I feel obligated. I feel like I'm going to be rendered responsible. If I don't pass this on, he's going to say when I meet him up there in my maker, he says, "What did you do with this gift of sobriety I gave you? What did I give to you?" I think one of us, I said, we got a precious gift, but we got to pass it on. We can't just sit here in these rooms and expect, you know, that there's a lot of people out there dying with this disease. And it's our job to help pass it on. And I really feel very responsible for that. And it seems like it's becoming stronger and stronger in my heart. That's just, as I said, that's just my own opinion. I am going to close this with what simple prayer that I always close my leads with, because I can't think of anything more that I could wish for you. I firmly believe that God has a message, or has a dream for every single one of us when he created us. That he had a vision, right? He had, you know, a dream that he wanted you to be happy, joyous and free, and have a life of fulfillment. That was God's dream for every one of us. We all got detoured somewhere along the line, or we wouldn't be in here today. And but today my prayer is that God, I'm going to ask the same thing as a prayer. God, by the time that each one of us, our lives, each one of us at the end of our lives, let's blank this all to start over. God, by the time we reach the end of our lives, that each of us in this room be the kind of person that you had in mind when you created us. And thank you.